Essay number 3, I'm Dreaming My Life Away. Part 1. Till the end of the world rolls round, I'll keep on loving you. Long as the sun goes up and comes down, big blue sky goes down to the ground. Long as the world goes round and round, I'll keep on loving you. Fake banjo. That's the only phrase I wrote down after waking from this dream on the night of September 5th, and I'm glad I did. It allowed me to remember and recover at least a portion of what I know was a longer and more complex dream, the details of which were, of course, lost in the absence of a more extensive mnemonic. But what was conserved has turned out to be, over the last week or so of thinking, extraordinarily useful to me. So, the dream, or at least a portion of it that pertained to this fake banjo business. On stage, in a scene being broadcast live for an internet audience, is a bluegrass band, a very good one, with a fantastic banjo player. I can't remember what song they were playing, but it was a brisk one, like the one I quote above, a favorite of mine, with lots of banjo. The lighting is too low, though, to highlight anyone in particular, including the banjo player, who remains anonymous. Off to the right of the band, the left side of the screen from my point of view in the dream, in a bright spotlight is me, pretending very animatedly to play the banjo, using exaggerated motions and gestures in a clownish fashion to simulate what the real banjo player is doing. The effect of this, as you might imagine, is that the fake banjo player would be perceived as the center of attention and also, at best, as a kind of comic aside, a fool. But that's not what happened. For some reason, the audience loved this parodic commentary on the performance. And the fake banjo player very quickly clicked his way into a viral sensation on his way to becoming a cultural meme. Since I was a fake banjo player, I had to decide, figure out how to feel about all of this while it was happening. Initially, I was irritated, not quite angry, but affronted that I was being insulted in this way. My getting famous, I mean, for this thing I was incompetent at, when all the things I do extraordinarily well get no public notice at all. Then I thought, okay, this is an embarrassment, but maybe I can use it to direct at least some of this audience to those other kinds of performances, writing especially, that, like the real fake banjo player I've been working at for most of my life and am now quite good at. In other words, I thought, public notice, even fame, for the things I want attention for, might come secondarily from avid fans of the fake banjo player. When I woke up, that's where my reading of this dream stood, a vague sense that I might one day achieve notoriety for some stupid thing I do badly, and that would lead to greater notice for the smarter things I do well. But I've been thinking through the implications of this image in the meantime, and now realize that's not what this dream was about at all. For one thing, I and everyone else with a computer or a phone knows that's not how the internet works. Viral fame is almost always forever attached to the original meme. Internet fan energy is rarely transferred to more legitimate or worthy endeavors. Even artists who had some relatively positive, if modest, reputation for their work inevitably lose even that when they are memed, rickrolling, one good example. So, in effect, once a fake banjo player, always and only a fake banjo player. I'd rather stay where I am, I finally concluded, beneath notice, except for the few people, including me, who read my work, than to trade all of that in to become simply and solely a mega-famous, flash-in-the-pan, fake banjo player. Again, I thought that was it. But on my walk today, the implications began to expand to the broader social sphere, to include friends, colleagues, peers, of course, but even more so, intimate and romantic partners. All relationships which often operate invisibly on a similar fake banjo economy, in that they evolve and even depend on the many masks we craft and put on to win approval from others. Dating site profile gambits are a good example. Everybody a winner, sensuous, good-looking, exciting. Such masquerades are inevitable, of course, even essential for survival in a community or the pursuit of social or sexual happiness. The problem arises when we begin to substitute those appearances for reality, gradually losing contact with our intrinsic self, you might say, and more pointedly, to let others do that to us. Or, to pick up my dreams analogy, we gradually give up our real music and specialize instead in fake banjo playing. Why? Because it works, often more effectively than playing our preferred instrument well. One of the inevitable problems with this kind of self-marketing is that once it begins to work as clickbait, you become tempted to keep up the charade indefinitely, or risk disappointing your audience. Romantic or intimate relationships are already, by their nature, complicated enough. For one thing, men and women in search of a partner often have a specific template in mind at the outset, a paradigm, if you will, that dominates their process. There are gender-specific stereotypes that guide those paradigms, as well as individual quirks and expectations. As such relationships emerge, both parties are constantly sending off specific cues and clues about the kind of partner they prefer. And the one on the receiving end, if they want what's being proffered, often creates a sort of a fake banjo version of themselves to satisfy those preconditions. The longer this goes on, I know from experience, the harder it becomes to escape those externally imposed but self-accepted constraints and just be oneself comfortably. At some point, it's just too late to go back to being yourself without risking the whole enterprise. There is a sort of a Pavlovian mechanism that enforces these boundaries. Reward for meeting the requirements of the paradigm, penalty for violating it. Control is paramount in this, and usually one party establishes that sooner or better than the other, to the detriment, I would argue, of both parties, at least in the long run. My wife Carol explained to me not long after we met that her previous lover had a habit of saying she was almost perfect, after which he would indicate what the specific deficit was. So she'd attend to that as best she could. But as anyone who has ever been in such a dysfunctional relationship knows, there will always be another thing that crops up to forestall the progression from almost to perfect. In other words, you will never get there, and it's by design. The chronically critical partner would lose control if the process were complete. And control is, of course, the issue here. I had never thought much about this, but realized I had been in relationships like that, one in which my almost perfectness, yes, it is, of course, easy to presume that I am almost perfect, became a chronic condition, ultimately depressingly so. I decided right then two things. If someone I'm romantically interested in ever says I'm almost perfect, I'd walk away right then, save myself lots of time and torment. And if I'm romantically interested in someone, I want to feel and let them know, right from the outset, that they are already perfect, just the way they are. Thus, the lyrics above. That is what unconditional love is, says, and does. as I was explaining to my friend last night while we were talking about this dynamic, it doesn't mean that the other might not want to change, even dramatically, for what they feel is the better. And, of course, it presumes that the other will change, often, again, dramatically, just by happenstance. It's just that at every stage along the way, the perception of perfection needs to be felt and communicated. I compared this to how you feel about your child when they are born. They are perfect, but you certainly don't want or expect them to stay infantile forever. They grow and change transformatively over the years, and in the case of my children, the decades. Yet somehow they are always perfect to me. Here's a stanza from another song I like that I think captures this succinctly. I said I love you, and that's forever, and this I promise from the heart. I couldn't love you any better. I love you just the way you are. That is unconditional love, which says over and over, at every step of the way, through all the changes and permutations, come what may, I love you just the way you are. What a great song. Even normal social relations are prone to this fake banjo affliction. We all want to have friends and be part of a community, and at one end of the spectrum, when we are absent friends or new to a community, we're often willing to make significant sacrifices in our authenticity to achieve those goals. At the other end of the spectrum, those already well ensconced often feel justified in prescribing the qualifications an outsider needs to demonstrate to be worthy of inclusion. At the most dysfunctional extreme, applying some type of Real Housewives or Proud Boys template for inclusion. The desire for and pursuit of fame per se, as distinct from specific performances, is another arena where this process plays out, in the sense that once you have done something to achieve it, you are tempted to keep doing the same thing, or to inhabit the persona that achieved it so fully there is little room for anyone else in there. Quite often, the road to recognition is paved with a lot of fake banjo playing. Pressing the flesh, currying favor, cynical social networking, until that's what seems real, or is all that is left. Writers, artists, and in my experience, scholars, sometimes end up spending so much of their inner capital to achieve notice and then sustain it, that they lose connection with the rich, complex self that generated the real music in the first place. In any case, my general advice would be to can the fake banjo act. No matter how famous or loved or befriended you might become via that sort of performance, you'll be trapped forever in its stupidity. About 20 years ago, my wife and I built cheap homemade banjos from a kit. They didn't sound that great, but I learned to play mine a bit. No matter how hard I've tried to make music, and I've tried hard, it never turns out very well. And almost no one I know besides me really likes it much. That was the case with my banjo music, too. By the way, you may or may not like my writing either, but that's no fake banjo act. And I plan to keep on loving it, no matter how invisible I am on that great outstage, while everyone else is distracted by some fake writer out there in the spotlight gyrating wildly as if that's what matters until the end of the world rolls round. Part 2. I can make you mine, taste your lips of wine, anytime, night or day. Only trouble is, gee whiz, I'm dreaming my life away. That's a stanza from the Everly Brothers song, which provides the title for this essay. I woke up a little while ago with a plan in mind to write a brief coda to this essay, mostly just an argument, or more accurately, just a reminder to set your brain free to do what it's designed to do. But now there is more stuff that seems to want to get said. So, in deference to my emancipated brain, which is doing all my work now, I'll do my best to say it. First of all, I had some great dreams last night, a process truncated by the fact that I woke up at 3 a.m. and couldn't get back to sleep. So here I am, writing this instead of dreaming. Since I missed the second half of my night's normal dream progression, I have little of consequence to say about them. But I want to write about one scene in particular, just so I'll remember it. I was walking in the mountains somewhere, a place ultra lush with greenery and flush with all kinds of water. At one point, I came out into a clearing and saw below me a gorgeous lake surrounded by great trees, in the middle of which on a tiny island was a huge, and I mean huge, oak tree, multiple trunks, each 5 or 6 feet in diameter, the massive branches levering out in the manner of southern live oaks, nearly reaching the shores of the lake. I thought, this is where I'll build my house. As I walked down the hill, I could see that the lake's outlet gushed down a steep incline, so fast that if you slipped into it, you would surely be lost. And someone or something told me, this is where the river starts. I recall some subsequent details from the dream, but I want to forget them. This scene I want to remember forever. And now that I have this reminder, I know I can and will. I've built my house for the last 6+ years in the woods. The last 3+ of those years also by the water. That's where my head lives, and to be honest, has always lived. I recall as a boy going down to the river that ran through our town, more a large stream, I guessed, but one that rushed along magnificently. There was one spot down a steep bank overhung with heavily leafed branches where I could reach a huge boulder that jutted out into the water that was particularly swift and turbulent, a spot completely out of sight from any angle. I would sit there and stare at the trees and the water until I wasn't really there as a me any longer. More presence that mingled with these other presences which were my wonderful friends, as I was theirs. Now, I'm here, 60 years later, essentially doing the same thing, like Wordsworth's William sitting on a stone, apparently doing nothing, much to the chagrin of his friend Matthew, who asks, "Why, William, on that old gray stone, this for the length of half a day, why, William, sit you thus alone and dream your time away?" Matthew thinks William should be studying, making something of himself in worldly terms. William answers this way, "The eye, it cannot choose but see. We cannot bid the ear be still. Our bodies feel, where'er they be, against or with our will. Nor less I deem that there are powers which of themselves our minds impress, that we can feed this mind of ours in a wise passiveness. Think you, mid all this mighty sum of things forever speaking, that nothing of itself will come, but we must still be seeking? Then ask now, wherefore, here, alone, conversing as I may, I sit upon this old gray stone and dream my time away." So Wordsworth's William has something in common with the Everly brothers. Probably the first time these three people have appeared in the same sentence together. And I am a lifelong practitioner of the wise passiveness required for extended rock sitting. Wordsworth wrote a companion piece for this poem called The Tables Turned, which is just William speaking. Here are a few stanzas from that poem. One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good, than all the sages can. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous form of things. We murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. I had no intention to write about any of this. All sentiments I fully endorse when I sat down. But it all seems pertinent to me now, almost 4 a.m., September 26th, 2021. Part 3. A few months ago, as I said, without any specific plan to do so, I just stopped writing. I stopped making videos of my readings of poems. I stopped making slideshows from photos I take. I stopped singing. I stopped playing my guitar. I stopped sending all that stuff I've been crafting to the gradually diminishing list of friends willing to tolerate it, my primary audience, since I started my little cottage industry of stuff crafting 6 years ago. What a wonderful relief to me. As I'm sure it was to those people afflicted by my many missives, since no one seemed even to notice or complain. Until a couple of days ago when I heard from a very kind man in Pittsburgh wondering what was up with that. As I said above, this cessation left my head blessedly blank, full of space to begin to do more important work on behalf of something deeper, both in me and with the world around me. A month later, I quit all my volunteer jobs here to vacate even more space in my head. And by that means, all of it, I set my brain completely free to do what it was designed to do, what it enjoys doing, what it's had a hankering to do, for its own pleasure, yes, but also with the most generous spirit I now see, for my benefit as well. The summer that intervened has been the most magical time of my life. My inner weather an exact match for 3 months of utterly perfect weather here in Olympia. Aside from a couple of inordinately warm days, it was day after day of bright sunshine, blue skies awash with floaty, fluffy clouds, temperatures in the 70s or 80s, lush gardens with wave after wave of flowers all over town where I walked. There have been roses in full bloom all summer long, as well as the bleeding hearts bush outside my front door, as if they have never heard of drought and could care less about it. Overwhelms of greenery in the woods, including the endless savannas of ferns beneath the great cedars, firs, hemlocks, and alders. And countless waterways where I stand and watch the tidal ebbs and flows from vantage points all over the immediate area. The boardwalk downtown, Evergreen College, Woodard Bay, Watershed Park, Burfoot Park, you name it. Water, water, everywhere. All that the eyes can drink. With the exception of two quickly written poems and a weird essay on quantum mechanics, now the penultimate essay in this book, the inside of my head has been crickets. When my brain wants to talk to me, it waits until I'm asleep. Thus all these dreams. Though I'd have to say that even while I'm awake these days, it feels similarly dreamy, just seeing, savoring, loving, whatever from out there that happens to find its way in here, like the way Wordsworth's William dreams his time away in that poem. Now I'm writing again. I have no idea why. It just started up out of the blue a week or two ago, as it has over and over during my journey in the chillest land and on the strangest sea. Those are Emily Dickinson's words of my solitary life these last 6+ years. The quote I took from the Everly Brothers begins, "I can make you mine, anytime, night or day." Obviously, they're singing about a fantasy, romantic relationship, one that exists pretty much only inside a head, the way mine do now, as I've said. But that line also keys into something I've been thinking about these last couple of days, in the aftermath of a conversation with a friend about ways to promote self-love, so crucial in a culture where its flow from the outside in is so often choked off by fear. I was explaining to her about the multiple alter egos I have in my head, which speak to me and one another in various ways, each with a sort of role to play in my overall identity parade. And I told her that I say over and over to myself, "I love you, Paul." A gesture of self-care I've come to cherish and have repeatedly recommended to others, using their own names, of course, not mine, lately in conversations, essays, and poems. That sentence has two pronouns, an I and a you. I have no idea how many I's I have in me, but it must be at least two. The caretaker who is offering love in this sentence and the more general I that is the composite of all the other I's, I assume there are more, and the multitude of you's in there, a number I can't even hazard a guess at, though Virginia Woolf playfully calculates it as 2052. Emily Dickinson calls this composite I her me, Whitman his me myself. Which is to say there are other authors and poets operating with this kind of internal bloom and buzz and confusion. What I spontaneously realized for the first time and told her was that the Paul in that sentence, the noun I name with my actual name, the Paul in my identity parade, is always the one who desires and receives love and care, which issues from other destinations within, including from the seemingly impersonal executive I in that simple sentence. I have no clear idea who that I is or why he, she, they are so caring and generous and strong. I have no idea either whether anyone else's inner world is divided up in quite this way. All I want to say now is that if you have an I of this sort in there, one that is clear-minded, wise, and strong, listen to it. It wants what's best for you, knows how to care for you, it loves you. I just right now decided to call that I my brain. In keeping with my theme in these three dream essays, the one I more fully emancipated a few months back, though I've clearly had it on a very loose leash for most of my life, as you know, if you talk to me or read what I write. You have a brain, too, with similar superpowers, looking for opportunities to help you. Set it free. Emancipate it. It will repay you handsomely. As for me, only trouble is, gee whiz, I'm dreaming my life away. And once I finish this essay and get it and its companions uploaded to my website, I'm going to go back to doing that full time again.